The owners of the land came onto the land, or more often a spokesman for the owners came. If a bank or finance company owned the land, the owner man said, "The bank or the company needs, wants, insists, must have," as though the bank or the company were a monster with thought and feeling which had ensnared them. These last words would take no responsibility for the banks or the companies because they were men and slaves, while the banks were machines and masters all at the same time. You see, a bank or a company, those creatures don't breathe air, don't eat side meat. They breathe profits. They eat the interest on money. If they don't get it, they die. The bank, the monster, has to have profits all the time. It can't wait. It'll die. No, taxes go on. When the monster stops growing, it dies. It can't stay one size. We have to do it. We don't like to do it, but the monster's sick. Something's happened to the monster.
"Sure," cried the tenant men, "but it's our land. We measured it and broke it up. We were born on it, and we got killed on it, died on it. Even if it's no good, it's still ours."
"We're sorry. It's not us. It's the monster. The bank isn't like a man."
"Yes, but the bank is only made of men."
"No, you're wrong there, quite wrong there. The bank is something else than men. It happens that every man in a bank hates what the bank does, and yet the bank does it. The bank is something more than men. I tell you, it's the monster. Men made it, but they can't control it." Did any of you recognize that passage? It is from John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. But we have only begun to love the earth. We have only begun to imagine the fullness of life. How could we tire of hope? So much is in bud. How can desire fail? We have only begun to imagine justice and mercy. 2 weeks ago, the youth of this congregation spoke to us about the decline of violence from times long ago up to the present. Our wonderfully bearded friend and scholar, and sometimes Santa Claus, Bob Ladner, had a great deal to do with that presentation, I think. It was based in part upon a book by a Harvard psychology professor named Steven Pinker entitled The Better Angels of Our Nature. And last week, Turner Stokes alluded to some of those circumstances of life around us that are part of our current events that continually jar us and disturb us and shake our equilibrium. Things like the Trayvon Martin case that is unfolding as we speak in our national dialogue. Surely it may be true that violence has declined, but it is still with us. It is a reminder that it is but one piece of a much larger discussion we need to be having regarding related issues. And one of those issues is what we have commonly called justice. Pinker's work, and I've started to read it. Is Bob here this morning? Bob's not here.
Bob McAllister is here.
And one of his two daughters is here. Three daughters. And how many sons? One son. Okay, for purposes of review, have you all got that now? Okay, thank you very much. Now, where was I?
Pinker. Pinker. Yes. Pinker's work is an extremely valuable piece, I think, because it helps us to understand many of the psychological reasons for our behavior, including behavior that is deemed violent. And especially, I'm particularly interested in this because it is so relevant for the political scene right now, especially behavior that is based upon rigid ideology, the kind that resulted in the past in such things as the Crusades and the Holocaust and the genocide in Rwanda. And I don't treat that issue lightly at all. It can also help us understand the dynamics of empathy, which I think is at the very heart of what we commonly refer to as our spirituality. Partly for the sake of continuity, and partly because I think that we need to get on with the business of straightening out what spirituality is all about, and partly because we are at an important juncture in our nation's history, and finally because we are on a very, very important journey in our congregation toward what I trust will be a brilliant future of service to humanity, I invite you to explore what I think may be, in part at least, new territory for some. Not just justice, but what might be called distributive justice. And it is tricky stuff. Generally, we think of justice in terms of retributive justice. It is justice that has punishment at its core. In biblical times, it was maybe summarized with the phrase, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You'll find that in the book of Exodus if you want to refer to your Bible, which I know all of you keep on your nightstands and particularly read Exodus and Leviticus every night before you go to sleep. Many countries like our own have developed legal systems that are supposedly built around the concept of retributive justice. And under such systems, the guilty are punished for their transgressions against the community, and the innocent are supposedly let free. We can all think of examples of retributive justice. Suppose a pedestrian is killed by a drunk driver and then leaves the scene of an accident. On the news then that evening, there is a member of the family probably crying, rightfully outraged at what has happened, and exclaims to the news reporter, "All the family wants is justice." That's retributive justice. They want accountability for something that has happened to them, some compensation, if you will, for their pain. Justice has another dimension, however, that we don't very often examine very carefully. I'm not a law expert, I'm out of my depth, but it is in understanding in jurisprudence that if it is the law, that is, if it appears on the books, there is the presumption somehow that it is just, perhaps in an elementary sense, but it is supposed to be just. The problem is that the so-called powers that be are the ones who have written the law, and they are also the ones who will interpret the law. And it is difficult to ask the question whether or not the law is actually fair. Take, for example, the system of slavery that was part of our nation's history for so long. Or a less extreme example, the passage of great literature that Carol and I read a moment ago from Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath serves as introduction, I suppose, and is a case in point. The banks came in and repossessed the land that had been in families for generations. They did it because they could do it. because it was deemed to be fair and just. Well, fair and just for whom? If you see parallels to our own recent crisis in the housing market and with foreclosures, then you're right on target. The system is structured in such a way that it most always favors people and the institutions that are in power. And indeed, some have suggested that when laws are written, and I think this is very much the case today, even before the ink is dry, the loopholes have already been figured out so that when enforcement time comes, the powers that be will always have the advantage, a just way out. What we do not have enough of is rules that protect the ordinary person from the rapacious few, whether they be bankers or Paul Ryan's proposed budget. But none of this is really distributive justice. Simply put, distributive justice does what is right because it is just, and what is just by doing what is right. It deliberately starts at a different point, that is, beyond the law, and takes into consideration the whole sweep of circumstances that are relevant, and bases its decisions upon radical principles of fairness and equity, not related to things, but related to people. Now, how does this work? I want to introduce you to somebody, and I hope you will look him up on Google him or get on YouTube and watch some of his presentations because he's brilliant. His name is Brian Stevenson, who is the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative organization, I think it's called, that promotes human rights and social justice on behalf of the mentally ill, the poor, children, and adolescents, and particularly those who are incarcerated. He works every day with the marginalized, the condemned, and almost always with poor people. And characteristically, they are people without hope. We live in a nation, my friends, with an incredible amount of inequality, and along with that inequality, sharply increased levels of poverty. Indeed, the bottom 30%, think of it, the bottom 30% of people who live in poverty in this nation are systematically ignored, have no impact whatsoever on legislators or on people who are lobbying for laws in our land. They have zero impact. 30% of all people living in poverty. In 1970, 350,000 people were in jails or prisons, compared to 2.2 million today. Another 5 million are on probation. And there is little doubt that this situation is born out of the politics of fear and anger and a good dose of racism tossed in. And it should come as no surprise at all to any of us that as programs to combat poverty have been decreased and in many instances eliminated altogether, the level of incarceration has gone up proportionately, so that now the United States has the very highest incarceration rate of any nation in the world. With over 46 million people living below the federal poverty line, we have chosen to address the problem with greater levels of incarceration. We have also addressed mental health issues by imprisoning people. More than 50% of all of the people who are in jails or prisons have mental health problems, with most of them not receiving any treatment at all. And then, of course, there is the problem of race. One out of every 100 Americans in jail or in prison, one out of every 100 Americans is in jail or prison. But for African Americans, the rate is 15%, or 15 out of every 100. Communities of color are often targeted with unequal law enforcement, and too often the presumption of guilt hangs heavily upon black and brown people, even though they may be innocent. It may very well be, as you know, that this presumption was operative in the Trayvon Martin case. Sentences for crimes have gotten harsher and harsher, to the point where it has become ridiculous. Three strikes laws have ended up putting people in prison for life for doing such things as stealing a bag of golf clubs. And we are the only nation on this earth who sentences children as young as 13 to die in prison. The death penalty costs billions of dollars and produces unreliable results. For every 9 people we have executed in the last 40 years, there has been one person on death row who was innocent. If we had that kind of record, say, in building jetliners, with 1 out of 9 likely to crash, would that be acceptable to us? Perhaps instead of asking the question of whether or not a person has the right to live after committing a crime, we might ask whether we have the right to kill. Stevenson's experience has shown conclusively that if you are rich and guilty, you will be treated much better than if you are poor and innocent. Yet we remain a people who are relatively unwilling to talk about race and poverty, and the despair that is pervasive in a very significant portion of our population. When deprivation is systemic, when the spirit of the soul is denied significant nourishment from health care, from good education or adequate housing or decent job opportunities, hope dies. And not only does hope die, but a person's sense of worth dies with it. An identity of being somebody is destroyed. And when the rich ingredients of distributive justice that Laura talked about this morning, that we talked about as side issues, health care, child care, education, particularly job opportunities, when those are systematically denied a large portion of the nation's citizenry, our very spirit as a people hangs in the balance. And our claim to be a spiritual people, a religious people, an empathetic people, begins to vanish, and the soul is challenged, and our spirituality is called into question. Stevenson tells a story to illustrate all of this in a somewhat humorous way, and yet it is very, very profound, I think. He grew up in a large family. His mother was one of 10 children. His grandmother lived in the home, and she was very clearly the matriarch of the whole brood. She herself was a child of slaves, having been born in 1846. As Stevenson says, she was the end of every argument in the family. Nobody dared cross her. She had the habit of giving the children these giant hugs, so strong that it took the breath out of them. Sometimes they thought they were going to die. But they were nonetheless hugs of genuine love, and they knew it. When he was 8 or 9 years old and sitting in the living room one day, his grandmother kept staring at him, and she stared and stared and stared, probably for more than 20 minutes. And finally she motioned to him to follow her, and she took him into the bedroom, a place where they could be private. And she says, "Brian, I've been watching you." Well, of course, he knew that already, and he was rather dreading what was coming next. And then she said, "We need to have a talk." Well, that was even more ominous. And then she said, "I think you're special. I think you can do anything that you want to do. Just promise me 3 things. First," she said, "love your mom." Okay, reasonable. 2, a little harder, "always do the right thing, even when it's the hard thing." And 3, "never drink alcohol." Years later, when Stevenson was 14 or 15, he and a bunch of his cousins, now you remember there were a lot of them, because there were 10 children in this family and they all had children. So a bunch of them snuck off to the woods, and one of them had gotten a hold of some beer somewhere. They were hidden and were not going to be discovered, and they sat down to drink this beer. And they offered it to Brian, and he refused. He said, "No, not going to do it." And they kept begging him, "Well, have some beer, you know, it's going to be fun." And he was absolutely adamant. He wasn't going to touch the stuff. He remembered the promise that he had made to Mama. That's what they called the grandmother, Mama. And his cousin turned to him and said, "Brian, I hope you're not still hung up on that conversation that Mama had with you. She took all the kids aside and told them that same thing." Stevenson is now 52 years old, and he has never touched alcohol in his life. Not because he is virtuous or righteous, and not that he has any problem with other people drinking it, but because, as he puts it, there is an extraordinary power in identity. Think of that. There is an extraordinary power in identity. And Mama gave him his identity. He was special. We are called to speak out, and our 7 principles provide a wonderful framework for the pieces of distributive justice. They call us to be challenged by human suffering wherever we see it, and challenged by the despair that is so much a part of our culture, a culture that has conditioned us, I fear, not to see it as we should. For in the end, we all know that the opposite of poverty is not wealth, but it is worth, a sense of self-worth. And identity that says to everyone, you are special, and you deserve to be treated as though you are special. And maybe as a nation, we will one day be defined not by our military might or our gross national product, but by our compassion toward the poor and the condemned, and our firm commitment to our own humanity. As Stevenson says, we need to talk about injustice so that we can create distributive justice. So be it.